I want to point out that there are quite different dosages which have been selected for patients, for example, on prevention of deep venous thrombosis and for atrial fibrillation, a 2 times higher dose here, a 2 times higher dose for apixaban, a 1.5 times higher or the same dose for dabigatran. So that is already strange, that there is a different gradient in the use of the dosages of different drugs for different indications. Well, the notion that you may need different dosages for different indication is based on the fact that the thrombotic risk is different for various indications, and that is not only true across indications, but even between groups of patients. For example, when I take some data from a conference published in 2004, even within atrial fibrillation, you can distinguish low-risk and higher-risk patients, and the risk in patients with valve protheses is about twice as high as the risk in patients with atrial fibrillation, particularly for mitral valve protheses with the current dual leaflets. With the older single leaflet aortic valve protheses, the risk is at the same level and twice as high as with the newer dual leaflet aortic valve protheses. But this is very different from the story that we have with warfarin or with the coumadins in general. These are the recommendations from the European Society of Cardiology, and there are no recommendations for the use in acute coronary syndromes. However, we might extend that perhaps when you add the data from an overview, a meta-analysis of all the trials done with warfarin on top of aspirin and then titrated to a proper INR 2 to 3 times versus aspirin. In that combination, there was a reduction of death, myocardial infarction or embolic stroke of about 25%, which was significant. You needed to treat 33 patients to avoid one event at the cost of more major bleeding, and the number needed to harm was 3 times higher than the number needed to treat. So if you would add that to the previous slide, you get a list of recommendations for the use of warfarin in different indications, and then it is striking that the dose adjusted to the INR is the same for all the different indications, apart from some of the valves where you would have a higher level of INR to strive for. Now, this is very different, and I just put aside just one of the drugs, with, for example, rivaroxaban, which has a 4 times higher dose for the indication atrial fibrillation than for the indication acute coronary syndromes, and a 2 times higher indication for atrial fibrillation compared with deep vein thrombosis. That is at least something to think about, whether we have really done it right. We have this one dose for warfarin, and we have different dosages for the newer anticoagulants, while dose adjustment, even with warfarin, is only recommended for valve protheses and not for other indications. Now, we must realize, and it was already pointed out, that warfarin has a broader action than the newer anticoagulants. They are specific inhibitors, but the aspecific, the broader action of warfarin, may be disadvantaged in terms of a higher risk for intracranial hemorrhage, but it may also be of advantage in patients who have a higher thrombotic risk. And you might, for example, think about patients with a valve prosthesis. While also in valve patients, the risk is very high early on, in the first weeks and months after surgery, while the risk stabilizes after 3 or perhaps even 6 months when the sutures have been endothelialized and the risk for stroke is going down. In patients with acute coronary syndromes, but also with all the other indications, there have been specific dose-finding studies for the newer anticoagulants. But the results of these dose-finding studies are somewhat challenging and very difficult to interpret. And I'll go back once more to the dose-finding studies with rivaroxaban, where they try to find the window of opportunity where the thrombosis risk is at an acceptable low level, although it never will be completely zero, and the bleeding risk is not yet increased that much. Now, if you have patients who are at a higher risk for thrombosis, this window will shift. For example, the curve might look more like this. Huh? And the dose-finding studies with rivaroxaban I think do not give a very clear message, but of course, apart from what is given in the publication, there is much more data available to the industry and the investigators. For bleeding, clinically significant bleeding, there is indeed a dose response in patients receiving aspirin alone, and somewhat a dose response in patients receiving aspirin and clopidogrel. This was the placebo data. But in terms of efficacy, there is no real dose response. And the investigators, in retrospect, wisely picked the two lowest dosages. But it's very strange that you find an efficacy signal here and not at the higher dosages, which at least I do not really understand why that would be the case. So the complex dose selection for phase 2 data raised the question whether we really have found the optimal dose. And to approach that, indeed, as mentioned earlier, phase 3 studies with multiple doses, I think, should be recommended to have a better feeling for the dosage, like was done in RELY and the ATLAS acute coronary syndromes studies. But furthermore, I think we should raise the question whether the single dose for a given indication is really optimal for each individual, or whether we should adjust the dose based on patient characteristics or perhaps measurements of coagulation. And with these questions, I would like to end, indicating once more that the range for dosing is different for the new anticoagulant, the ratio between one indication and the other, and that makes you doubt whether you really have found the optimal dosing for all of the newer anticoagulants. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Now the lectures, both lectures are open to discussions. So if there are questions, if there are comments.
I have a quick comment. The DVT-P treatment for rivaroxaban is 20, not 40. It's 30 followed by 20. Yeah. It was 15 BID for the first 3 weeks followed by 20 QD for the remainder there.
I'd just like to make a comment that I think it's interesting the comparison between the factor 10 inhibitor or the new antithrombin agents versus the warfarin studies that were done. I mean, it's part of the issue is related to the fact that it's a different era. You know, the agents were tested in a different era. So the warfarin studies were done in an era that really wasn't clopidogrel use, and in contrast to the factor 10A inhibitors or the new antithrombin agents, in which, and I'm specifically referring to the ACS population, right? So the antiplatelet burden is much higher today. So there may be some explanation for why they're not only not seeing the differentiation across the different indications when you're referring to warfarin versus the more contemporary studies, and in fact, I think there's a very conscious effort to avoid using the higher doses in a ACS population, the more contemporary population, because it was well known, even with non-clinical studies, that there was potentiation of the antithrombotic effect when we're combining the, for example, the factor 10A inhibitor with clopidogrel or aspirin, even so. I think that's in part one of the reasons for some of the differentiation by dose, but I agree that there probably could be more clarity in terms of dosing by indication.
I think I also have a comment and question related to this dosing issue, but I also wondering whether you don't believe that we should also try to agree on the comparator dose. It's not only a problem of the active agent dose, but even the comparator dose is different from one study and one design to the other. And this has been already present, for instance, fondaparinux, if I recall correctly, were tested against one dose of enoxaparin in deep vein thrombosis against the double dose of enoxaparin in acute coronary syndromes. And so the issue is it is unlikely to be exactly similar in both cases. Either in one case it was probably not too strong and the other was too weak. It's unlikely that it's appropriate to compare it with two double doses of the same agent. And so one should first assess what is the appropriate dose of the comparator in that setting, and then to make the comparison. And my second question was whether we would agree that, for instance, in the comparison between rivaroxaban and apixaban, the reason that one using one-fourth of the dose in the acute coronary setting compared to the deep vein thrombosis is better than the second study, which used the double dose compared to the deep vein thrombosis, is mainly based on the presence of a background strong antiplatelet treatment, which suggests that very likely it's better safe to be on a very low dose when you add a third agent. Whether we would agree on this concept?
Only a short comment I want to add. In the presentation, there were very little about the unfractioned heparin, despite the fact there were some published materials demonstrating that unfractioned heparin in subcutaneous small dose is as effective as a new low molecular weight heparin, and maybe, I don't know, as a new anticoagulants. But unfortunately, heparin has no patent, so no patent, no friends. But I think heparin it's also an alternative for.
I think it's also quite important for us to, when we're looking at different dosing for different indications, is to also discuss this stacking issue. I think that one of the things that's happened in acute coronary syndromes is that we've continued to stack drugs on top of each other, and now we're up to triple therapy in acute coronary syndromes, and adoption of these types of therapies in the real world becomes extremely difficult and almost unmanageable in many, many cases. We have data from Frake's group showing that preliminarily in Wurst that you were able to actually take away aspirin with good results. And so this is yet another conundrum that I think we're all facing in finding the right dose and really thinking about the stacking issue and how we might be actually, maybe in ATLAS, and we go back to Mike on the other end of the table, maybe we could have had the 5 milligram dose with a good result if we didn't have aspirin in the equation in that arm. So that's another, I think, interesting comments to talk about.
Yeah, I agree with Roxana. We have to probably begin to move away from stacking to subtracting. And Roxana is absolutely right. In ATLAS, if you get rid of clopidogrel, not aspirin, get rid of clopidogrel in the aspirin alone patients, the 5 milligram dose was better than the 2.5, consistent with what we always think, that higher doses give you better efficacy. However, there are reasons why less is more, why lower doses may give you better efficacy than high doses. And one of them is high doses cause bleeding. And bleeding does more than just give you a safety signal. Bleeding may cause you to discontinue the active drug, but it may also cause you to discontinue all the other drugs that you're on. So you kind of fall off the evidence-based track when you have bleeding. So again, less may be more, even with respect to efficacy, if it keeps you on the evidence-based medicine track.
And we saw the same in the Pentua study led by Maarten Simons, where four doses of fondaparinux were compared in a phase 2 trial to pick out the right dose for fondaparinux and ACS. The lowest dose, 2.5 milligram, with fondaparinux, which is kind of indirect 10A blocker, worked best, where the higher doses gave more bleeding and were less efficacious than standard of care called enoxaparin. So the dosing is very, very important, I think. And second to what Mike says, if you can drop clopidogrel in such patients, then it's a huge benefit. But who would like to drop clopidogrel in a patient who survived ACS and got stented for that indication? Nobody. You may drop aspirin. That may be very interesting. And in fact, there is now a study planned or already started called COMPASS. That is a study which is far beyond secondary prevention. You need at least 1 year remote MI. It's kind of charisma study, where aspirin is compared to aspirin plus rivaroxaban in the dose which was efficacious in ATLAS versus 5 milligrams BID of rivaroxaban without aspirin. Very interesting study. And another study where aspirin is left out, is the Global Leaders Study. Maybe one of you are familiar with that one. That is where ticagrelor plus aspirin after stenting for ACS, or and also electives, all comers, randomized to ticagrelor plus aspirin versus ticagrelor alone. And in the ACS population, they have 1 month of aspirin. So maybe dropping one may be also very interesting with regard to bleeding. And bleeding nowadays means mortality. You will not bleed to death, but there is something going on in a patient who's bleeding, who gets a worse prognosis. And maybe the stopping of life-saving agents may be one of the clues, or transfusion. I don't know what it is, but it's a marker of future death.
John?
Okay. Just to elaborate more on Frick's points about ACS. First of all, there appears to be a distinct difference between the thrombotic time-related risk of patients with a heart valve, for example, or AFib, which is probably constant over time, versus ACS, where a patient has very high risk up front, but as time goes by from the index event, that risk tends to decrease over time. So people have survived after 30 days, are at lower risk than they were the first 30 days. And you can probably apply that to 6 months and 12 months. And that's when it gets interesting. Stacking versus subtracting, it might be reasonable to stack therapies at the time when the risk is really high and revert to lower grade therapies for the long term, where bleeding tends to show up in the long term and may be a problem. And since we're talking about future trials, and Mike Gibson is here, is going to be one of the leaders of the Horizons 2 trial that we're going to test next year in primary PCI, where patients that have not suffered an event at 30 days could potentially switch from a prasugrel-type antiplatelet therapy to a clopidogrel for the long run from 30 days onward, and get rid of the bleeding but maintain modest protection. So the time-related event thrombotic risk may be also a consideration to introduce in future trials. The same agents may not be needed in the first 48 hours or 30 days versus 12 months down the line.
I think that's absolutely right. I think we need to match the level of aggressiveness with the level of risk, and we have not done a good job of that. And what's more, I think we have to understand the biology better. I think we have an increasing understanding that ACS, you have acute coronary syndrome. We have acute activation of platelets. Those platelets tend to calm down after about a month. However, on the thrombin side, having excess thrombin generation seems to be more of a chronic risk factor, and that may speak more towards a higher level of chronic treatment for that side.
Other comments or questions?